As we continue in worship, we do so now in the reading and teaching. And I want to start by asking you to go a little bit deep and reflective in your own life this morning with me. And I want to ask if you've ever been in a space in life where you literally can't see a way forward for yourself. Like you have no idea what your next step ought to be. It's a space that's often haunted by questions like, am I ever going to love or be loved again? You ever been in a space like that? It's haunted by questions like, am I ever going to live a day where anxiety and fear don't find me? Is anyone ever going to hire me again? Is this illness, this heartbreak, this loss, this hell ever going to go away? That space is called wilderness. That space is called wilderness. There was an ancient people called the Israelites who had been enslaved in a land and by a people that weren't their own. They were exploited and abused in ways that I think we could all agree no human being should ever have to endure. They were born into slavery, were forced to work 7 days a week with no rest, no relief, and absolutely no reward. If they didn't work hard enough and produce at absolute capacity, their lives were expendable. All day, every day, they made bricks. That's what they did. Moms and dads with their kids making bricks. No holidays, no beach days, no mimosas on the patio. A life of making bricks. They were exploited and beaten and robbed of all human dignity, and they were in this land called Egypt. But the mind-blowing thing when you read the Israelite story in the ancient Hebrew Bible is that Egypt was never the space that the Israelites resented the most. There was another space, a different space, even worse than enslavement in that place. As bad as Egypt was for the Israelites, it wasn't the existential bottom for them. There was this guy named Moses who was a pretty complicated guy. He was an Israelite by birth, but was actually raised by Egyptian royalty. So he should have been amongst the oppressed, but at least for the first quarter or so of his life, he lives amongst the oppressors. And Moses ends up leading this uprising of emancipation where the Israelites march out of Egypt across the Red Sea, and he leads them into this new space, beyond the brutality of Egypt and into the wilderness. So think about this with me. For the first time in generations, centuries, some scholars say 430 years, an entire nation is set free from slavery, abuse, and oppression. They've escaped the horrible place back there. They are now free. How elated should these Israelites be, right? They should be over the moon. Yet listen to what they say in Exodus 16. The whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin, which I always thought was Vegas, but apparently it's between Elim and Sinai, just so you know. And on the 15th day of the second month after they had come out of Egypt, so they've been free for about 10 weeks. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron, the ones who led them out. The Israelites said to them, if only we had died by the Lord's hand, where? In Egypt. If only we were back there. If only we had never come out of that hellhole that was Egypt to begin with. It would be better for us to be dead in Egypt than to be alive right here. We want to go back there. The Israelites are free, they're no longer slaves, and what's the one thing they want more than anything else? They want to go back to Egypt. They want to go back to what they know. They want to go back to the familiar, the predictable. They want to go back there. Because even the hell that was Egypt feels better than 10 terrifying disorienting weeks in a space called wilderness. Have you ever been there? Have you ever been in a place called wilderness? Have you ever been in a space where everything within you longs for something that once was, but it's just no longer there for you? A relationship, a job, a sense of security, a person, a dream, a naivety, a innocence, an embrace, a belonging. But you now know from where you stand, you can't ever get it back. And you're scared to death because you have no idea what you're going to do without it and what comes next. That's a space called wilderness. For some, wilderness happens in an instant. It's when a loved one dies or a romance fails or a job is no longer yours. You're thrown, thrust into the wilderness. For others, myself in this category, wilderness didn't happen in an instant. For me, it came as a slow and gradual loss when the conservative religious world that I was immersed in, that I loved, that I served, that I belonged to, made it clear that because of my emerging beliefs, I could no longer belong to them. My first steps toward the wilderness space happened for me on March 10th, 2006, one of the, by far, hands down, most beautiful days in my life. I remember it clearly. It was a Wednesday, and remember, this is 2006, so my wife Marisol and I are at home, and we're watching The OC. I think it was season 2. It was good for the first 2 seasons, and then it, right? So season 2, we're watching The OC when Marisol went into labor with our first child. And we got to the hospital. It didn't happen watching The OC. We got to the hospital, and everything was right, and she gave birth to her daughter, Hudson. And as I held this 5-pound, 6-ounce little bundle of joy in my arms for the very first time, I'm going to be honest with you, I changed on every level. But I think the most obvious, at least from where I'm situated, the most obvious level where this little child changed me was theologically, which is weird, right? See, I'm ordained as a minister in a conservative Baptist denomination, the Fellowship of Evangelical Baptist Churches of Canada. We're Canadian. And it is conservative. Like, it is like women still can't speak in church or be elders kind of conservative. And I don't want to brag on myself, but I think I was pretty good at being a conservative Baptist minister. And I could hold my own in that world. But the truth is, the moment I held my daughter was the moment I realized that if God really is like a parent, right? Because we read the Bible and Jesus prays, "Our Father," like he relates God to a parent. Or Jeremiah talks about how God holds us like a mother holds a child at her breast. So God is like a mother. God is like this divine parent in some way, shape, or form. And as I become a parent in that moment, then the possibility of this angry, retributive thing called hell and God punishing people, and you better be afraid of God, just stopped being meaningful to me on that March 10th moment. I mean, no doubt, especially as she's nearing her teenage years, my little girl is going to have times when she's going to want nothing to do with me and reject me. She could rebel against me. She could tell me she hates me. She could do whatever she wants. And I'm never going to want to like lock her up and torment her and torture her. My heart for her as a parent is only ever going to be good. Because what kind of parent would ever want to harm their child? The angry God narrative that I'd built my theology and ideology around didn't hold up that first moment I held my little girl. The two don't correspond. If we were to understand God as a parent, then the instant I realized God can't be, he can't be, or she can't be coercive and fear-mongering to elicit our love. For no parent worth half their weight would ever approach their child that way. That was my first step toward the wilderness of no longer believing with the consensus of my conservative religious community. Or there was my friend, Anon. Anon owned the sandwich shop right around the corner from the church that I was a minister at in Canada. And because I'm terrible at making my lunch, literally 6 days a week, I would go to Anon's sandwich shop and he would make me a sandwich. He's a sandwich artist, you might say. And after coming in day after day, he got to know that I would order the same thing, so I wouldn't even have to ask. He would see me, and he would start making the sandwich, and we would, you know, exchange pleasantries. But before long, maybe a month or two into it, the pleasantries actually became real conversation. And Anon would make me a sandwich, and then he would make himself a sandwich. He would come out from behind the counter, and we would sit in a sandwich shop, and we would talk. We'd have lunch together, and we'd join each other's company. Anon had a fascinating story. He's what we would call a new Canadian, or also known as an immigrant. He and his young wife had recently immigrated to Canada from India. And they had a brand new baby, just weeks old. They had bought this brand new business. They were new to the country. I mean, just this fascinating guy. And I came in, and I often would come from a hospital visit or a funeral, so I'd have my clergy collar on. And so he knew I was spiritual, so we'd have some spiritual conversations. He was Sikh. And after our friendship got deeper and deeper, he said, listen, do you want to come to my temple sometime and see what my religion is all about? And when somebody asks you that, that's an honor. And you say yes every single time. And so I went to the Sikh temple, and I remember it was this crazy, insane snowstorm, but we way through, it was about 40 minutes away, we get there, and I was treated like royalty. I mean, I sat with the temple leaders, and we had lunch, and we had fun, and it was this beautiful experience, and I came back, and I was telling people at the church I led, and I was all excited about it, and a few people asked me the same kind of question. Hey, have you led Anon to the Lord yet? Have you told him what he needs to hear so he can go to heaven yet? Have you given a chance for Anon to accept Jesus? And when they said it, just something didn't sit right. Because as I watched Anon and his faith, the spirituality that sustained he and his wife in a move from India to Canada to buy a new business, to have a baby, a faith and a spirituality that had nurtured him and his ancestors for generations. Like who am I to say, oh yeah, by the way, Anon, you're far from God, and unless you believe and do spirituality and faith and religion the way I do it, you know, it's not going to go well for you in eternity. It's a little bit like telling the 90-year-old Holocaust survivor that what they really need in life is Jesus. Well, no, they've come this far. Maybe we need to just stop and listen to them. And in seeing the irony of it all, I took another step closer to the wilderness of no longer believing in the consensus of my conservative religious community. Where there was that time 6 years ago. A friend and I were on holiday in Chile, South America. And we were driving from one beach town to another beach town, as you do when you're on holiday. And traffic was really bad. It felt a little bit like LA, and we're driving along, and well, chugging along barely, but we noticed this old brown Datsun, like 1980s vintage Datsun car, parked on the side of the road, pulled right over onto the grass. And we noticed it because just outside of it was this couple, we assume boyfriend and girlfriend, and they were in an argument. And it caught her eye. He was in board shorts and flip-flops, had a sleeveless shirt and a ball cap, and he was pretty tatted up, and was the kind of guy that probably had a few protein shakes in his day, right? He was a pretty big dude. And we noticed it because as they were arguing, it quickly escalated, and he started to beat on her pretty good. And nobody's doing anything. The cars are just kind of chugging along by. You can see people watching. Nobody's doing anything. And now remember, we're in Chile. You can't just dial 911, or at least maybe you can. I don't know what the number is. So I look at my friend. My friend looks at me. We're two pastors. We're two small, like, little guys. So I pull the car over, and just adrenaline kicks in. I jump out of the car, and I yell at him, you wait here with the car. And I go running back. He's probably about 40 yards. I go hustling back, and in my terrible Spanish, I'm yelling to this young woman, "Do you need help? Do you need help?" And right when I get to the Datsun, the back door opens, and another protein shake dude gets out of the car. And right now, there's me and these two dudes, and he stopped hitting on his girlfriend, and he's noticed that I've come to help. And I'm going to be honest with you, without exaggeration, the look in his eye was sheer hate for me. I knew he wanted to do one thing, and both of them started coming at me, and they just wanted to put the beat down on me. What do you do in that moment? I don't doubt for a second that I didn't do the right thing. Probably did the wrong thing, but I, you know, the fight or flight thing kicked in, and I chose flight in that one. I hightailed it back to the car. I jumped in, and we took off and spent the next 40 minutes trying to find a police officer who actually didn't really even care when we found him. 3 weeks later, I got back, well, I got back to the church about a week later, but 3 weeks after that was Good Friday. And I had to preach a Good Friday sermon, and I knew what I was supposed to preach because I had done it for many years. On Good Friday, you're supposed to preach that the good news is that God is so holy and perfect that when he looks at us, at our sin, he can't stand it. So what God wants to do is punish us and pour out his wrath and his anger and this violent vengefulness on sinners. But Jesus steps in the way and says, "No, God, don't do it. Father, don't do it. Out your vengeance and your anger and your violence on me instead." And so what we're supposed to preach in conservative Baptist circles is that's what happens on the cross, is God pours out all his violence and anger on Jesus on the cross, so now God won't pour it out on us. And as I started to write the talk, I'm thinking, well, wait a minute, how is God any different than the douchebag on the side of the road in Chile? You know, all they wanted to do is pour out their anger through violence, whether it was on his girlfriend or on me. Somebody just needed to feel pain. Do we really want to believe that that's who God is? And in writing that Good Friday talk, I took another step closer to the wilderness of no longer believing with the consensus of my conservative religious community. And if you take enough steps in that direction, guess what begins to happen? One day you realize that you no longer believe what those around you say you're supposed to believe. And in conservative religion, when you stop believing, sadly, so does the belonging. Relationships and friendships and belonging is gone. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? You ever hear the term cognitive dissonance? Cognitive dissonance, what it is when two cognitions or two ideas or two beliefs logically contradict each other. They create a friction, a negatively experienced tension that needs to be resolved within our thinking. It's called cognitive dissonance. So, legit, relevant example. The environment is important. We need to take better care of our environment. Coal mining jobs are important. We need more coal mining jobs. Logically, you can't hold on to those two beliefs or cognitions simultaneously. You can't believe that we must take care of the planet and believe that we need to burn more coal at the same time. One idea is in direct opposition to the other, right? You see that? When one experiences cognitive dissonance, it produces a negative drive within us, much like, say, hunger. Hunger is the negative drive which compels us toward food. Weariness is the negative drive which compels us towards rest or sleep. Cognitive dissonance is the negative drive which compels us to reimagine what we know or believe about some part of the world so that it has coherence, so it makes sense, so it fits in a whole. There's a unity of truth, Pannenberg would say. So some people have invented the term clean coal, right? If we just rebrand coal as being fine for the environment, then there's no more dissonance, tension gone. So when you're in a conservative religious context, and everyone in the group says that God is a loving parent that has a wonderful plan for your life, and if you don't get on board, there's going to be an eternal hell to pay, it's legit to experience a level of cognitive dissonance. And for a lot of us, when we felt that tension and brought those hard questions to our former religious leaders, the message was clear. Don't ask those questions. Don't raise those doubts. Suppress it. Even spiritualize it, right? Call it a mystery. God's ways are not our ways. And I get why people suppress. I get why people suppress their spiritual cognitive dissonance. I get why people don't want to raise the questions. And the reason has nothing to do with the intellect at all. I don't think it has anything to do with intellectual integrity. I think it has everything to do with belongingness. Because if you don't raise the questions, if you just stay in your lane, believe as you've been taught, submit to the tradition, if you don't rock the boat, you are welcome and you are loved and you are part of the tribe. And the familiar and the predictable and the relationships and the acceptance and the belonging and the land is yours to stay in. You get to stay where you are. And it might feel confining. There might, parts of it that might feel redundant and it might feel a bit enslaving. But at least you get to stay. Whereas if you refuse to live with the dissonance, if you refuse to stop asking the questions, if you insist on seeking a coherence between believed reality and experienced reality, if you insist that God would never eternally condemn the beauty that is a human being or hate a sexual minority or silence women or predestine someone for eternal damnation, you will quickly discover in conservative religious communities and families that perhaps you no longer belong. And that can be an isolating, disorienting space that feels a lot like wilderness. Am I talking to anybody this morning? It's called wilderness. And the Israelites could never go back to Egypt. Yeah, they were free from coercion. They were free from fear and bondage that enslaved them. But before they could get to where they wanted to be, they had to spend this awful time in the wilderness. And I think their story has something significant to teach any one of us who can relate to the wilderness experience. So I want to just quickly, to end here, draw out two kind of hopefully relevant things that you can take for anybody here who is in their own wilderness. And the first one I would want to leave you with is this. The wilderness was never intended to be navigated alone. A wilderness experience, that place where you know you can't go back, but you have no idea what's coming next, has to be one of the most isolating and disorienting experiences in human life. The Israelites got to do it together as a people. And I think one of the most beautiful things about our little church here at Central Ave is that so many of us know that we cannot go back to the religion of our past. We might not even know where this thing is going. Like maybe we listen to Aaron or whoever speaking and it's like, well, I'm there yet and I don't know if I get it all and I don't know if it fits for me. And maybe our parents or our friends are scared to death for us. They're worried about our souls. Yet we come each week and we gather and together we pray and we sing and we learn and we give and we share and we explore, because a day in the wilderness is hard enough to get through when you're doing it alone. So we come week after week because we want to face it with people who know we that care. Often when you lose your job or a relationship or a faith, ultimately what you're losing is a sense of belongingness. Somewhere to love and be loved, to need and be needed, to hear and be heard. The wilderness can be the space where you wonder, who are my people? Where's my tribe? Where do I even belong in this world? And this is one of the reasons why I love St. Paul, the Apostle Paul. You ever wonder why he's so obsessed about starting churches? He like starts a church and they keep screwing it up and getting it wrong and missing the whole point. So he goes back and he stays with them, or he writes a letter, or he sends a messenger, all the whole time starting new churches in new parts of the ancient world. Paul keeps starting churches. I think he's compelled to do it because he went through a radical wilderness experience himself. He writes in Philippians chapter 3, "If someone else thinks they have reason to put confidence in the flesh, I have more. Circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews." Like, look, I belonged to these people. Like, I have a tribe, the Hebrews, they're my people. I was deeply enmeshed in their way, in this tribe. I was a Pharisee, as for zeal, persecuting the church, as for righteousness based on the law, I'm faultless. I'm really good at doing this conservative religious thing, he says. "But whatever were gains to me, all the identity and acceptance and love and existential meaning I found in that, now comes at an enormous loss for the sake of Christ." See, one of the reasons Paul is so committed to starting churches, I'm convinced, is because he knew that when you move beyond a narrow, constraining religious tradition and find a faith and a spirituality that is exponentially more generous, it's so hard. There's the gain, he says, that comes with the freedom, but the pain of being ostracized and losing relationships and people looking down on you is a legit pain. So Paul is deeply committed to setting up these new communities, these alternative pockets of belongings where people don't have to go through the wilderness alone. He says, who can belong to them? And he says, anybody, neither Jew nor Gentile, neither slave nor free, nor is there male or female, for all are one in Christ Jesus. Paul is deeply committed to places of belonging where it doesn't matter what you believe. Who cares what your status is, whether you're employed, whether you've arrived, whether you fit the mold, whether you conform to someone else's religious ideal, whether you can sign the doctoral statement or the organization's code of conduct. It doesn't matter. Who cares? You just belong. That's central. That's what this church, that's what you've been for our family. An oasis of belonging. And I know it would be so easy to give, all of us, to give up on church when you've come out of the confines of religious fundamentalism or conservatism. But Central Avenue is proof that that's exactly when church, good church, open church, boundless church, is needed the most. So in 10 days, our family moved back to Toronto, Canada. But Central has been one of the most formative experiences in my life and in our family. What you guys are doing, or what you're not doing, who you're welcoming, who you're loving, the ways you've situated yourself in the world, I don't know if you can appreciate how revolutionary it is. I hope you do. It's prophetic. Central Avenue is an oasis of belonging for those of us who know what wilderness is. And let me leave you with this. For my wilderness walkers this morning, just as God led the Israelites in a pillar of smoke and fire through the wilderness, please don't for a second think that because you're in the wilderness, Christ isn't leading you. Romans 8, Paul says, nothing can separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus. The lure or the leading of God is always present in your life. And it's always leading you in a direction towards justice, and love, and forgiveness, and creativity, and beauty. And we can stand in the wilderness place feeling alone and terrified and paralyzed by the unknown. But even there, the leading of God in your life is toward justice, and love, and creativity. So if you're not sure what your next move in life is, I get that. Move towards justice. Move in a direction of equality and creation care and inclusion. Not sure what your next step is? I get that. Step towards generosity. Not sure what the next chapter is going to be about, that's fair enough, but you can write the title today called Love. Not sure what's behind the next door, I get it, but knock on it with kindness and compassion. Not sure which way is up, I know exactly what that feels like. And loving, forgiving, serving, creating is always the direction God is leading you. So friends, peace to you who walk in the wilderness.